a lot of use of the computer in Sphere, and I kind of wondered what you were using.
No, it was a Macintosh. In fact, some of the material in Sphere is a code, a very simple letter substitution code, and it began to be clear, of course, that when the book is translated into different languages, all that graphic material is going to have to be reconstituted. And I began to realize that I didn't want to do it. So some of it is a lot of it was actually done with computer programs. So I've been sending the programs to foreign publishers saying, you do it. This is the program. You go get a Macintosh and run it through with whatever the sentence equivalents are in Norwegian and Swedish. And
so these codes in here, these have real meaning. I mean, they're not just graphics.
No. If you want to go through and play the game, I mean, it all makes sense. Sure. Absolutely.
Which is why when this is when it goes into foreign translations, it can't be faked.
No, I mean, you would have to change all that. Yeah. They'd have to redo it for every foreign edition.
Which Mac do you use?
I use a Plus. I haven't got a... I'm waiting for two.
You're not going to go halfway and get an SE?
I'm not going to get an SE, no.
I'd like to get an SE and use it at home and bring my Plus here. Problem is, in a newsroom where everything is exposed, a lot of people do have their own machines. There's an Atom over there where you were.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of people have K-Pros they brought in. They hide the keyboards, and the K-Pro has a case that they can lock up. The Mac is pretty vulnerable, though, and it's so small that I have this worry that if I brought my Mac in after I got an SE and left it on a newsroom desk, that it might be...
somebody else's Mac.
Well, theoretically, you're supposed to give the guards package passes to get out, but you never know about these things. Well, I have to say about Sphere, I have to complain about it a little bit. You kept me up until 2 o'clock in the morning reading it, so you really cut into my sleep.
Sorry about that.
I couldn't put it down. A couple of questions come to mind. One is the habitat that you have created in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Is there anything like that now? Or is this something out of the imagination of Michael Crichton?
Well, I think there used to be habitats like that. But habitats have, in part, gone into disfavor. I mean, there are very industrial habitats that are used, for example, in the North Sea for oil drilling operations. And divers go down there, and it's a very grubby environment, saturated diving environment. There are not the sort of plush habitats that are described in this book.
But there could be.
There could be, sure.
Another question comes to mind. I didn't, maybe this was probably because I started to get pretty drowsy because I read the book, and I started, I believe, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and just kept on reading. There was a really dramatic episode where the hero is in the submarine and he's being chased by this giant squid. And the tentacle is coming up through the various decks trying to reach out him, and he looks out the porthole and he sees the eye, and he realizes that this squid is tracking him from outside. Why does the water just rush into that sub? I mean, how could that squid get that arm up there, not have the sub flooded by water?
Oh, that's just the experience that you'd have if you take an empty glass and turn it upside down and hold it in a bathtub. I mean, the water won't fill the glass. Right? I mean, the if there's a pressure inside an inverted glass, it will hold the water out, and there will be just a floating water level.
And that's why they were able to come in and out of the airlock without any problem.
Right, because the atmosphere inside the habitat is pressurized to equal the outside seawater.
Well, knowing you, I would assume that all or most of the science in this book is pretty accurate, isn't that right?
It is pretty accurate. There's one area of which is tremendously wrong, and there was nothing I could do about it. Just in order to tell the story, I had to live with that. But
you don't want to divulge that?
I don't think it's just a trivial technical point, and it's not very important. But I know of one glaring error. But otherwise, no. My intention is to make these things pretty accurate, and it's. I think the fun of it for me is to do it in a very detailed way.
Well, now you're talking about black holes and time travel, and there's a lot of dispute about things like that, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I mean, but I don't mind. I mean, my sense of playing the game is that if it's an area of disagreement or an area in which no one knows. I mean, the fact of the matter is that. We don't even know for sure of any black hole. I mean, we think we have the locations of several of them, and we think we know quite a lot about the behavior of them, and there are some people who think, or at least have thought in the past, that a rotating black hole could conceivably be entered and passed through. A stationary black hole couldn't, but a rotating black hole could. And that the possibility therefore exists, the possibility exists that one could go through a black hole and come out somewhere else. So I think that's a current speculation, and it's available for use in a speculative book. I don't think that, I mean, I didn't make it up, is what I'm trying to tell you. I got it from someone else.
Well, now you're a practical guy. You live with the sheer practicalities of putting novels together and directing motion pictures. You have an MD from Harvard, so you're not one to let the flights of fancy go through your mind too much. I would assume you have your feet on the ground. What are your personal opinions about going back into space and creating the kind of situation that actually happened in Sphere?
Do you mean, do I think that the book is possible?
Yeah.
I think that I guess my immediate answer is no, but my answer to almost everything I've written was that I don't think it's possible. What interested me in this thing, Don, was to take a book in which a very extreme situation was presented to a group of people, and then to see how this group of people responded to the extreme situation. And so I didn't really want to spend too much time challenging the extreme situation itself, you know, to say how realistic is this. What I was trying to do the book about was to say what would happen to people if they were confronted by this extreme situation. What would happen to people if they were confronted by, as a given, as a premise, the possibility of time travel, the possibility of contact with an extraterrestrial artifact, something that comes from another civilization. It's very much more advanced than ours. And I think that all I would say in defense of the extreme premise is that if you put yourself 100 years ago, it takes anyone from 100 years ago. Take Charles Darwin, pretty knowledgeable guy from that time, and plunk him in front of a Macintosh, you know, the chances are he would run screaming from the room. I mean, it cannot be anything but witchcraft. And if you decide to sit down and say, okay, Chuck, let me explain to you how this works, it involves whole fields of knowledge, highly developed knowledge, he didn't know anything about. The electron hasn't been discovered yet. He doesn't know what an electron is. And so he certainly doesn't know anything about electronics. He certainly doesn't know anything about solid-state electronics. He certainly doesn't know anything about cathode ray tubes, and he doesn't know anything about... I mean, this is one giant piece of magic to him. And all he can really do is sit on the outside and look at it as some very strange rectangular object that has funny black and white shifting images on it. Now, if that's true in 100 years, then there must be something very much like it 50 or 100 years in the future, if we could see ahead and see what kinds of things we would be doing. And so this is a book about people who find something from, as it turns out, our own future.
Yeah,
it's pretty mysterious.
I believe you say in Sphere, in fact, that if you were to take a television set 100 or 200 years in the past, it would be worthless to anybody. You couldn't turn it on, even.
That's right. No place to plug it in.
I was talking not too long ago with Jean-Louis Gasset, who's the man currently behind the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. Well, all of the Macintoshes, I guess. And he, I asked him to speculate on the kinds of computers we might have in the future, and he said one thing that was interesting. He could see a computer that would be the size of this book or of a notepad, but instead of typing, you just write on it, and the computer will translate your handwriting. I don't know if that's an advance or not, but that would be one form of computers in the future. Another form would be, of course, just having a computer you can talk to and that can talk to you back. Do a little bit of that now, but it's very undeveloped. There's another form of computer that he told me about. I can't remember that. But it is interesting to see how we... Well, even computers. I think I read somewhere that the concept for a computer was pretty well established by the mid-40s, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And I read someplace, I'm sure you know more about this than I, that in order to create a computer of even the most primitive nature, it would have to use vacuum tubes. And it would cause such a... It would have to be so large that a simple computer would take up as much room as the Empire State Building.
Oh, yes. In fact, even the computers in the 60s, those big IBMs that were so terrific and lived in their own little rooms and stuff, were incredibly small. I mean, they are the size now. Those big computers of the 60s that I remember when I was in college, they are the size of pocket calculators almost. I mean, you know, they're 10K, 12K machines. They're tiny. And, I mean, no one would own a personal computer so small in terms of its memory now. I mean, it's a kind of a joke. And the kinds of machines that are for sale for a few $1,000s now that everybody can have and carry around if they want them were unimaginable 20 years ago. I mean, a man lived up the street from me who was a computer pioneer, and he once told me about programming a 256-byte machine. Not 256K, 256 bytes. I mean, it's ridiculous. So there have been extraordinary changes. I agree with you in terms of whether or not a future computer that can decipher handwriting is advantageous. But I can type, and I can type a lot faster than I can write. So I certainly think that to have many kinds of input devices is only advantageous.
Sphere is going to be one hell of a motion picture. Will you be directing it, writing it?
At the moment, I have no plans for either. It was, I think, in part a feeling I had that that my tendency to become involved in the film versions of my books might not be as good an idea as I originally thought it was. For one thing, it keeps me very much involved with a limited number of projects over a longer time. And for another thing, I sometimes think that there's a certain amount of energy that you have available for a subject, you know, or for a story. And by the time I've done the novel, I don't know if I really want to do the movie, to tell you the truth. And you know, how I got to this is actually the other way around. Is I'd done an original screenplay, and the studio began to say, why don't you do a novel? And I said, no, I don't want to do a novel. And I said, well, if you do a novel, you'll do the movie afterwards. And I thought, that's true, I will. And let's think about that. So, I mean, my sense is that it would make a good movie, and I don't think I should probably do it.
Be a hell of a movie, and it requires a degree of special effects, but they've been done. I mean, it's certainly possible to do it. I mean, as I recall, the Disney movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea had a giant squid, didn't it?
Yes, it is.
So, I mean, it's they could probably dust that off.
That's
and use
right. Let's find that squid and bring it back.
The old squid. Well, now, it was 83 that you wrote the title of which escapes me, the computer book?
Electronic Life.
And over this past 83... That's 4 years. So in addition to working on Sphere, what all have you been doing?
I've written another book, which is called Travels, which will be out next year. And I did a movie called Runaway that came out in 84.
Wrote
and directed.
Mm-hmm. The new book, is that also fiction?
No, the new book is not fiction. It's an autobiographical book, and it's... It began as a series of travel pieces. I've done a lot of traveling in the last, 20 years. And originally my idea was never to write about it. My thought was that I wanted to do something that I just did for myself and that it wasn't work-related and it wasn't supposed to amount to anything. It wasn't supposed to turn into anything. But as time went on, so many of the really important experiences in my life occurred on those trips that it began to seem almost evasive to me that I wasn't writing about it, and so I finally decided that I would. And once I was writing an autobiographical book, which I never thought I'd do, I began to think about some medical stories that I had always promised myself that I'd write, although not until enough time had gone by that they were pretty ancient history. And to my amazement, enough time has gone by, and it's more than 15 years since I went to medical school, so I've put those in there too.
Well, when you were in medical school, of course you were writing some potboilers, I guess, under pseudonyms to help pay your way through. Has the writing, how has your writing changed over all those years, and is it easier or harder than it was way back then?
I think that it's gone through many permutations, and I felt differently about it at different times. At this particular time, I'm very enthusiastic about it, and I have, it gives me a lot of pleasure. At other times, I felt very tired of doing it, and I felt like I've done too much, and I've wished for changes. And I think that, I guess there's a quality in me where I become alternately disaffected with either books or films, you know, and depending on what I've had the most recent difficult experiences with. And I think for a long time I thought, well, I don't see why I should continue writing books. I'd just rather work in movies. And then at a certain point I thought, wait a minute now, if I write a book, I don't have to talk to anybody else. I don't have to get anybody to say the lines. I don't have to get anybody to put up the money. I don't have to make any changes. I can have it be exactly the way I want. And I only have to deal with myself. And why is it that I'm not doing this all the time? You know, what was so wrong with that again? And so I really reconceived the advantages of that work.
Well, almost every writer I've talked to who has written for the movies, even from Sidney Sheldon on, have said that they prefer to write novels. It's easier, and for the reasons you've outlined. And ultimately, it's their work without the changes. It's usually the director's vision that alters books. They really upsetting things. Sometimes they destroy what the book is supposed to be.
Yes.
I don't know if that's... Well, that really hasn't happened to you so much, has it?
Well, it happened one time in a book called Dealing, and the which was intended to be an anti-drug book, and by the time the movie came out, it was a pro-drug movie, which was... but, no, I've actually had, in most cases, pretty good success with the movies, but it's It's an inherently hazardous undertaking, I think, movies. I mean, it's a large collaborative enterprise, and there are many, many pressures on it.
You're living in Los Angeles?
Living in Los Angeles.
Well, why don't you move out of Los Angeles? That helps to avoid the temptation a little better.
You mean the temptation to work in films?
Yeah, doesn't it?
I like to work in films. I mean, I find that it's a good counter balance in some way to, in other words, for pretty much the last 2 years, I've been very much in isolation. You know, I get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, I go to my office and I make a cup of instant coffee and sit in front of the Macintosh and write. And I'll do that, and then around 10 o'clock, people come into the office, and eventually I'll go to lunch, and I'll come back and work some more, and about 3 o'clock I'll quit for the day, take an exercise class, and go home. And I'll do that 5 or 6 days a week for months. And it's very, it takes a lot of energy, so that I don't really want to go out very much at night, and I don't want to go to dinner with people. I'm really focusing on my work. And after a couple of years of that, I mean, I think it's probably kind of healthy for me to be in a movie set and have 100 people and have a lot of talk and not to be by myself so much. And I feel that there's a... I could easily become a hermit-like if I'm not careful.
Well, the movies pay well, too, so I understand. And so that is also an inducement that... that has helped in many instances. I was talking to John Gregory Dunn, for example, who writes screenplays with his wife Joan Didion, who says that the movies have effectively helped to finance their writing habit.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true, John. I don't know. My experience is yes, they do pay well, and yes, you earn it.
Well, Michael Crichton, after 4 years, it's great seeing you again, and Sphere is just a really fascinating book that is a page-turner, and one that is, unless you drop off to sleep in the middle of a line, and that's very hard to do, it's almost impossible to put down. So for my small listenership, I'm certainly going to recommend it highly, and I appreciate you coming in. I know you have a coast-to-coast schedule, and it's probably a pain to have to come in and talk to another radio guy, but I appreciate it, and sharing your thoughts about the Macintosh as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doc.